5. Fat spent 13 days at North Ward, drinking coffee and reading and walking around with Doug, but he never got to talk to Dr. Stone again because Stone had too many responsibilities, inasmuch as he had charge of the whole ward and everyone in it, staff and patients alike. Well, he did have one brief dipshit hurried interchange at the time of his discharge from the ward. "I think you're ready to leave," Stone said cheerfully. Fat said, "But let me ask you. I'm not talking about no mind at all directing the universe. I'm talking about a mind like Xenophanes conceived of, but the mind is insane." "The Gnostics believed that the creator deity was insane," Stone said. "Blind. I want to show you something. It hasn't been published yet. I have it in a typescript from Orville Wintermute, who is currently working with Besky in translating the Nag Hammadi codices. This quote comes from On the Origin of the World. Read it." Fat read it to himself, holding the precious typescript. He said, "I am God, and no other one exists except me." But when he said these things, he sinned against all of the immortal, imperishable ones, and they protected him. Moreover, when Pistis saw the impiety of the chief ruler, she was angry. Without being seen, she said, "You err, Samael," i.e., the blind god. "An enlightened, immortal man exists before you. This will appear within your molded bodies. He will trample upon you like potter's clay, which is trampled, and you will go with those who are yours down to your mother, the abyss." At once Fat understood what he had read. Samael was the creator deity, and he imagined that he was the only god, as stated in Genesis. However, he was blind, which is to say, occluded. Occluded was Fat's salient term. It embraced all other terms: insane, mad, irrational, whacked out, fucked up, fried, psychotic. In his blindness, state of irrationality, i.e., cut off from reality, he did not realize that. What did the typescript say? Feverishly, he searched over it, at which Dr. Stone thereupon patted him on the arm and told him he could keep the typescript. Stone had Xeroxed it several times over. An enlightened, immortal man existed before the creator deity, and that enlightened, immortal man would appear within the human race which Samael was going to create. And that enlightened, immortal man, who had existed before the creator deity, would trample upon the fucked-up, blind, deluded creator like potter's clay. Hence, Fat's encounter with God, the true God, had come through the little pot Oh-Ho, which Stephanie had thrown for him on her kick-wheel. "Then I'm right about Nag Hammadi," he said to Dr. Stone. "You would know," Dr. Stone said, and then he said something that no one had ever said to Fat before. "You're the authority," Dr. Stone said. Fat realized that Stone had restored his, Fat's, spiritual life. Stone had saved him. He was a master psychiatrist. Everything which Stone had said and done vis-a-vis Fat had a therapeutic basis, a therapeutic thrust. Whether the content of Stone's information was correct was not important. His purpose from the beginning had been to restore Fat's faith in himself, which had vanished when Beth left, which had vanished, actually, when he had failed to save Gloria's life years ago. Dr. Stone wasn't insane. Stone was a healer. He held down the right job. Probably he healed many people, and in many ways. He adapted his therapy to the individual, not the individual to the therapy. I'll be goddamned, Fat thought. In that simple sentence, "You're the authority," Stone had given Fat back his soul. The soul which Gloria, with her hideous, malignant, psychological death game, had taken away. They, note the they, paid Dr. Stone to figure out what had destroyed the patient entering the ward. In each case, a bullet had been fired at him, somewhere, at some time in his life. The bullet entered him, and the pain began to spread out. Insidiously, the pain filled him up until he split in half, right down the middle. The task of the staff, and even of the other patients, was to put the person back together, but this could not be done so long as the bullet remained. All that lesser therapists did was note the person split into two pieces and begin the job of patching him back into a unity, but they failed to find and remove the bullet. The fatal bullet fired at the person was the basis of Freud's original attack on the psychologically injured person. Freud had understood. He called it a trauma. Later on, everyone got tired of searching for the fatal bullet. It took too long. Too much had to be learned about the patient. Dr. Stone had a paranormal talent, like his paranormal batch remedies, which were a palpable hoax, a pretext to listen to the patient. Rum with a flower dipped in it. Nothing more but a sharp mind hearing what the patient said. Dr. Leon Stone turned out to be one of the most important people in Horse Lover Fat's life. To get to Stone, Fat had had to nearly kill himself physically, matching his mental death. Is this what they mean about God's mysterious ways? How else could Fat have linked up with Leon Stone? Only some dismal act of the order of a suicide attempt, a truly lethal attempt, would have achieved it. Fat had to die, or nearly die, to be cured, or nearly cured. I wonder where Leon Stone practices now. I wonder what his recovery rate is. I wonder how he got his paranormal abilities. I wonder a lot of things. The worst event in Fat's life, Beth leaving him, taking Christopher, and Fat trying to kill himself, had brought on limitless benign consequences. If you judge the merits of a sequence by their final outcome, Fat had just gone through the best period of his life. He emerged from North Ward as strong as he would ever get. After all, no man is infinitely strong. For every creature that runs, flies, hops, or crawls, there is a terminal nemesis which he will not circumvent, which will finally do him in. But Dr. Stone had added the missing element to Fat, the element taken away from him, half deliberately, by Gloria Knudsen, who wished to take as many people with her as she could. Self-confidence. "You are the authority," Stone had said, and that sufficed. I've always told people that for each person there is a sentence, a series of words, which has the power to destroy him. When Fat told me about Leon Stone, I realized, this came years after the first realization, that another sentence exists, another series of words, which will heal the person. If you're lucky, you will get the second, but you can be certain of getting the first. That is the way it works. On their own, without training, individuals know how to deal out the lethal sentence, but training is required to deal out the second. Stephanie had come close when she made the little ceramic pot Oh-Ho and presented it to Fat as her gift of love. A love she lacked the verbal skills to articulate. How, when Stone gave Fat the typescript material from the Nag Hammadi Codex, had he known the significance of pot and potter to Fat? To know that, Stone would have to be telepathic. Well, I have no theory. Fat, of course, has. He believes that, like Stephanie, Dr. Stone was a microform of God. That's why I say Fat is nearly healed, not healed. Yet by regarding benign people as microforms of God, Fat at least remained in touch with a good God, not a blind, cruel, or evil one. That point should be considered. Fat had a high regard for God. If the Logos was rational, and the Logos equaled God, then God had to be rational. This is why the fourth gospel's statement about the identity of the Logos is so important. Kai theos ein halagos, which is to say, and the Word was God. In the New Testament, Jesus says that no one has seen God but him, that is, Jesus Christ, the Logos of the fourth gospel. If that be correct, what Fat experienced was the Logos. But the Logos is God, so to experience Christ is to experience God. Perhaps a more important statement shows up in a book of the New Testament which most people don't read. They read the Gospels and the letters of Paul, but who reads 1 John? My dear people, we are already the children of God, but what we are to be in the future has not yet been revealed. All we know is that we shall be like him, because we shall see him as he really is. 1 John 3:1-2. It can be argued that this is the most important statement in the New Testament. Certainly it is the most important, not generally known, statement. We shall be like him. That means that man is isomorphic with God. We shall see him as he really is. There will occur a theophany, at least to some. Fat could base the credentials for his whole encounter on this passage. He could claim that his encounter with God consisted of a fulfillment of the promise of 1 John 3:1-2, as Bible scholars indicated, a sort of code which they can read off in an instant, as cryptic as it looks. Oddly, to a certain extent, this passage dovetails with the Nag Hammadi typescript that Dr. Stone handed to Fat the day Fat got discharged from North Ward. Man and the true God are identical, as the Logos and the true God are, but a lunatic blind creator and his screwed-up world separate man from God. That the blind creator sincerely imagines that he is the true God only reveals the extent of his occlusion. This is Gnosticism. In Gnosticism, man belongs with God against the world and the creator of the world, both of which are crazy, whether they realize it or not. The answer to Fat's question, is the universe irrational, and is it irrational because an irrational mind governs it, receives this answer via Dr. Stone. Yes, it is. The universe is irrational. The mind governing it is irrational. But above them lies another God, the true God, and he is not irrational. In addition, that true God has outwitted the powers of this world, ventured here to help us, and we know him as the Logos, which, according to Fat, is living information. Perhaps Fat has discerned a vast mystery in calling the Logos living information, but perhaps not. Proving things of this sort is difficult. Who do you ask? Fat, fortunately, asked Leon Stone. He might have asked one of the staff, in which case he would still be in North Ward, drinking coffee, reading, walking around with Doug. Above everything else, outranking every other aspect, object, quality of his encounter, Fat had witnessed a benign power which had invaded this world. No other term fitted it. The benign power, whatever it was, had invaded this world, like a champion ready to do battle. That terrified him, but it also excited his joy, because he understood what it meant. Help had come. The universe might be irrational, but something rational had broken into it, like a thief in the night breaks into a sleeping household, unexpectedly in terms of place, in terms of time. Fat had seen it, not because there was anything special about him, but because it had wanted him to see it. Normally, it remained camouflaged. Normally, when it appeared, no one could distinguish it from ground. Set to ground, as Fat correctly expressed it. He had a name for it. Zebra. Because it blended. The name for this is mimesis. Another name is mimicry. Certain insects do this. They mimic other things. Sometimes other insects, poisonous ones, or twigs and the like. Certain biologists and naturalists have speculated that higher forms of mimicry might exist, since lower forms, which is to say, forms which fool those intended to be fooled, but not us, have been found all over the world. What if a high form of sentient mimicry existed? Such a high form that no human, or few humans, had detected it. What if it could only be detected if it wanted to be detected? Which is to say, not truly detected at all, since under these circumstances it had advanced out of its camouflaged state to disclose itself. Disclose might in this case equal theophany. The astonished human being would say, "I saw God," whereas in fact he saw only a highly evolved ultra-terrestrial life form, a UTI, or an extraterrestrial life form, an ETI, which had come here at some time in the past. And perhaps, as Fat conjectured, had slumbered for nearly 2,000 years in dormant seed form as living information in the codices at Nag Hammadi, which explained why reports of its existence had broken off abruptly around 70 A.D. Entry 33 in Fat's journal, i.e. his exegesis. This loneliness, this anguish of the bereaved mind, is felt by every constituent of the universe. All its constituents are alive. Thus, the ancient Greek thinkers were hylozoists. A hylozoist believes that the universe is alive. It's about the same idea as panpsychism, that everything is animated. Panpsychism, or hylozoism, falls into two belief classes. One, each object is independently alive. Two, everything is one unitary entity. The universe is one thing, alive, with one mind. Fat had found a kind of middle ground. The universe consists of one vast irrational entity into which has broken a high-order life form which camouflages itself by a sophisticated mimicry. Thereby, as long as it cares to, it remains, by us, undetected. It mimics objects and causal processes. This is what Fat claims. Not just objects, but what the objects do. From this, you can gather that Fat conceives of zebra as very large. After a year of analyzing his encounter with zebra, or God, or the Logos, whatever, Fat came first to the conclusion that it had invaded our universe, and a year later he realized that it was consuming, that is, devouring, our universe. Zebra accomplished this by a process much like transubstantiation. This is the miracle of communion in which the two species, the wine and bread, invisibly become the blood and body of Christ. Instead of seeing this in church, Fat had seen it out in the world, and not in micro form, but in macro form, which is to say, on a scale so vast that he could not estimate its limits. The entire universe, possibly, is in the invisible process of turning into the Lord, and with this process comes not just sentience, but sanity. For Fat, this would be a blessed relief. He had put up with insanity for too long, both in himself and outside himself. Nothing could have pleased him more. If Fat was psychotic, you must admit that it is a strange sort of psychosis to believe that you have encountered an inbreaking of the rational into the irrational. How do you treat it? Send the afflicted person back to square one? In that case, he is now cut off from the rational. This makes no sense in terms of therapy. It is an oxymoron, a verbal contradiction. But an even more basic semantic problem lies exposed here. Suppose I say to Fat, or Kevin says to Fat, you did not experience God. You merely experienced something with the qualities and aspects and nature and powers and wisdom and goodness of God. This is like the joke about the German proclivity toward double abstractions. A German authority on English literature declares, Hamlet was not written by Shakespeare. It was merely written by a man named Shakespeare. In English, the distinction is verbal and without meaning, although German as a language will express the difference, which accounts for some of the strange features of the German mind. I saw God, Fat states, and Kevin and I and Sherry state, no, you just saw something like God, exactly like God. And having spoke, we do not stay to hear the answer, like jesting Pilate upon his asking, what is truth? Zebra broke through into our universe and fired beam after beam of information-rich colored light at Fat's brain, right through his skull, blinding him and fucking him up and dazing and dazzling him, but imparting to him knowledge beyond the telling. For openers, it saved Christopher's life. More accurately speaking, it didn't break through to fire the information. It had at some past date broken through. What it did was step forward out of its state of camouflage. It disclosed itself as set to ground and fired information at a rate our calculations will not calibrate. It fired whole libraries at him in nanoseconds, and it continued to do this for 8 hours of real elapsed time. Many nanoseconds exist in 8 hours of RET. At flash-cut speed, you can load the right hemisphere of the human brain with a titanic quantity of graphic data. Paul of Tarsus had a similar experience, a long time ago. Much of it he refused to discuss. According to his own statement, much of the information fired at his head, right between the eyes on his trip to Damascus, died with him unsaid. Chaos reigns in the universe, but St. Paul knew who he had talked to. He mentioned that. Zebra, too, identified itself to Fat. It termed itself St. Sophia, a designation unfamiliar to Fat. St. Sophia is an unusual hypostasis of Christ. Men and the world are mutually toxic to each other, but God, the true God, has penetrated both, penetrated man and penetrated the world, and sobers the landscape. But that God, the God from outside, encounters fierce opposition. Frauds, the deceptions of madness, abound and mask themselves as their mirror opposite, pose as sanity. The masks, however, wear thin, and the madness reveals itself. It is an ugly thing. The remedy is here, but so is the malady. As Fat repeats obsessively, the empire never ended. In a startling response to the crisis, the true God mimics the universe, the very region he has invaded. He takes on the likeness of sticks and trees and beer cans in gutters. He presumes to be trash discarded, debris no longer noticed. Lurking, the true God literally ambushes reality, and us as well. God, in very truth, attacks and injures us in his role as antidote. As Fat can testify to, it is a scary experience to be bushwhacked by the living God. Hence we say the true God is in the habit of concealing himself. 2,500 years have passed since Heraclitus wrote, "Latent form is the master of obvious form," and "the nature of things is in the habit of concealing itself." So the rational, like a seed, lies concealed within the irrational bulk. What purpose does the irrational bulk serve? Ask yourself what Gloria gained by dying, not in terms of her death vis-à-vis herself, but in terms of those who loved her. She paid back their love with what? Malice? Not proven. Hate? Not proven. With the irrational? Yes, proven. In terms of the effect on her friends, such as Fat, no lucid purpose was served, but purpose there was. Purpose without purpose, if you can conceive of that. Her motive was no motive. We're talking about nihilism. Under everything else, even under death itself and the will towards death, lies something else, and that something else is nothing. The bedrock basic stratum of reality is irreality. The universe is irrational because it is built not on mere shifting sand, but on that which is not. No help to Fat to know this. The why of Gloria's taking him with her, or doing her best to, when she went. "Bitch," he could have said if he could have grabbed her. "Just tell me why. Why the fucking why?" To which the universe would hollowly respond, "My ways cannot be known, O man." Which is to say, my ways do not make sense, nor do the ways of those who dwell in me. The bad news coming down the pipe for Fat was mercifully still unknown to him at this point, at the time of his discharge from North Ward. He could not return to Beth, so who could he return to when he hit the outside world? In his mind, during his stay at North Ward, Sherry, who was in remission from her cancer, had faithfully visited him. Therefore, Fat had engrammed onto her, believing that if he had one true friend in all the world, it was Sherry Solvig. His plan had unfolded like a bright star. He would live with Sherry, helping to keep up her morale during her remission, and if she lost her remission, he would care for her, as she had cared for him during his time in the hospital. In no sense had Dr. Stone cured Fat when the motor driving Fat got later exposed. Fat homed in on death more rapidly and more expertly this time than he had ever done before. He had become a professional at seeking out pain. He had learned the rules of the game and now knew how to play. What Fat, in his lunacy, acquired from a lunatic universe, branded so by Fat's own analysis, thought was to be dragged down along with someone who wanted to die. Had he gone through his address book, he could not have yielded up a better source than Sherry. "Smart move, Fat," I would have told him, if I had known what he was planning for his future during his stay at North Ward. "You've really scored this time." I knew Sherry. I knew she spent all her time trying to figure out a way to lose her remission. I knew that because she expressed fury and hatred constantly at the doctors who had saved her. But I did not know what Fat had planned. Fat kept it a secret, even from Sherry. "I will help her," Fat said to himself in the depths of his fried mind. "I will help Sherry stay healthy, but if and when she gets sick again, there I will be at her side, ready to do anything for her." His error, when deconstructed, amounted to this. Sherry did not merely plan to get sick again. She, like Gloria, planned to take as many people with her as possible, in direct proportion to their love toward her. Fat loved her, and worse, felt gratitude towards her. Out of this clay, Sherry could throw a pot with the warped kick wheel she used as a brain that would smash what Leon Stone had done, smash what Stephanie had done, smash what God had done. Sherry had more power in her weakened body than all these other entities combined, including the living God. Fat had decided to bind himself to the Antichrist. And out of the highest possible motive, out of love, gratitude, and the desire to help her. Exactly what the powers of hell feed on, the best instincts in man. Sherry Solvig, being poor, lived in a tiny run-down room with no kitchen. She had to wash her dishes in the bathroom sink. The ceiling showed a vast water stain from a toilet upstairs which had overflowed. Having visited her there a couple of times, Fat knew the place and considered it depressing. He had the impression that if Sherry moved out and into a nice apartment, a modern one, and with a kitchen, her spirits would pick up. Needless to say, the realization had never penetrated to Fat's mind that Sherry sought out this kind of abode. Her dingy surroundings came as a result of her affliction, not as a cause. She could recreate these conditions wherever she went, which Fat eventually discovered. At this point in time, however, Fat had geared up his mental and physical assembly line to turn out an endless series of good acts toward the person who, before all other persons, had visited him in the cardiac intensive care ward and later at North Ward. Sherry had official documents declaring her a Christian. Twice a week she took communion, and one day she would enter a religious order. Also, she called her priest by his first name. You cannot get any closer to piety than that. A couple of times, Fat had told Sherry about his encounter with God. This hadn't impressed her, since Sherry Solvig believed that one encounters God only through channels. She herself has access to these channels, which is to say, her priest, Larry. Once, Fat had read to Sherry from the Britannica about the secrecy theme in Mark and Matthew. The idea that Christ veiled his teachings in parable form so that the multitude, that is, the many outsiders, would not understand him, and so would not be saved. Christ, according to this view or theme, intended salvation only for his little flock. The Britannica discussed this up front. "That's bullshit," Sherry said. Fat said, "You mean this Britannica is wrong, or the Bible is wrong? The Britannica is just..." "The Bible doesn't say that," Sherry said, who read the Bible all the time, or at least had a copy of it always with her. It took Fat hours to find the citation in Luke. Finally, he had it, to set before Sherry. His disciples asked him what this parable might mean, and he said, "The mysteries of the kingdom of God are revealed to you. For the rest, there are only parables, so that they might see but not perceive. Listen, but not understand." Luke 8:9-10. "I'll ask Larry if that's one of the corrupt parts of the Bible," Sherry said. Pissed off, Fat said irritably, Sherry, why don't you cut out all the sections of the Bible you agree with and paste them together, and not have to deal with the rest? Don't be snippy, Sherry said, who was hanging up clothes in her tiny closet. Nonetheless, Fat imagined that basically he and Sherry shared a common bond. They both agreed that God existed. Christ had died to save man. People who didn't believe this didn't know what was going on. He had confided to her that he had seen God, news which Sherry received placidly. At that moment she had been ironing. "It's called a theophany," Fat said, "or an epiphany." "An epiphany," Sherry said, pacing her voice to the rate of her slow ironing, "is a feast celebrated on January 6th, marking the baptism of Christ. I always go. Why don't you go? It's a lovely service. You know, I heard this joke," she droned on. Hearing this, Fat was mystified. He decided to change the subject. Now Sherry had switched to an account of an instance when Larry, who was Father Minter to Fat, had poured the sacramental wine down the front of a kneeling female communicant's low-cut dress. "Do you think John the Baptist was an Essene?" he asked Sherry. Never at any time did Sherry Solvig admit she didn't know the answer to a theological question. The closest she came surfaced in the form of responding, "I'll ask Larry." To Fat, she now said calmly, "John the Baptist was Elijah, who returns before Christ comes. They asked Christ about that, and he said John the Baptist was Elijah, who had been promised." "But was he an Essene?" Pausing momentarily in her ironing, Sherry said, "Didn't the Essenes live in the Dead Sea?" "Well, at the Qumran Wadi." "Didn't your friend Bishop Pike die in the Dead Sea?" Fat had known Jim Pike, a fact he always proudly narrated to people given a pretext. "Yes," he said. "Jim and his wife had driven out onto the Dead Sea desert in a Ford Cortina. They had 2 bottles of Coca-Cola with them, that's all." "You told me," Sherry said, resuming her ironing. "What I could never figure out," Fat said, "is why they didn't drink the water in the car radiator. That's what you do when your car breaks down in the desert and you're stranded." For years, Fat had brooded about Jim Pike's death. He imagined that it was somehow tied in with the murders of the Kennedys and Dr. King, but he had no evidence whatsoever for it. "Maybe they had antifreeze in their radiator," Sherry said. "In the Dead Sea Desert?" Sherry said, "My car has been giving me trouble. The man at the Exxon station on 17th says that the motor mounts are loose. Is that serious?" Not wanting to talk about Sherry's beat-up old car, but wanting instead to rattle on about Jim Pike, Fat said, "I don't know." He tried to think how to get the topic back to his friend's perplexing death, but could not. "That damn car," Sherry said. "You didn't pay anything for it. That guy gave it to you." "Didn't pay anything? He made me feel like he owned me for giving me that damn car." "Remind me never to give you a car," Fat said. All the clues lay before him that day. If you did something for Sherry, she felt she should feel gratitude, which she did not, and this she interpreted as a burden, a despised obligation. However, Fat had a ready rationalization for this, which he had already begun to employ. He did not do things for Sherry to get anything back. Ergo, he did not expect gratitude. Ergo, if he did not get it, that was okay. What he failed to notice was that not only was there no gratitude, which he could psychologically handle, but downright malice showed itself instead. Fat had noted this, but had written it off as nothing more than irritability, a form of impatience. He could not believe that someone would return malice for assistance. Therefore, he discounted the testimony of his senses. Once, when I lectured at the University of California at Fullerton, a student asked me for a short, simple definition of reality. I thought it over and answered, "Reality is that which, when you stop believing in it, it doesn't go away." Fant did not believe that Sherry returned malice for assistance given her, but that failure to believe changed nothing. Therefore, her response lay within the framework of what we call reality. Fat, whether he liked it or not, would in some way have to deal with it, or else stop seeing Sherry socially. One of the reasons Beth left Fat stemmed from his visits to Sherry at her run-down room in Santa Ana. Fat had deluded himself into believing that he visited her out of charity. Actually, he had become horny, due to the fact that Beth had lost interest in him sexually, and he was not, as they say, getting any. In many ways, Sherry struck him as pretty. In fact, Sherry was pretty. We all agreed. During her chemotherapy, she wore a wig. David had been fooled by the wig and often complimented her on her hair, which amused her. We regarded this as macabre on both their parts. In his study on the form that masochism takes in modern man, Theodore Reich puts forth an interesting view. Masochism is more widespread than we realize because it takes an attenuated form. The basic dynamism is as follows. A human being sees something bad which is coming as inevitable. There is no way he can halt the process. He is helpless. This sense of helplessness generates a need to gain some control over the impending pain. Any kind of control will do. This makes sense. The subjective feeling of helplessness is more painful than the impending misery. So the person seizes control over the situation in the only way open to him. He connives to bring on the impending misery. He hastens it. This activity on his part promotes the false impression that he enjoys pain. Not so. It is simply that he cannot any longer endure the helplessness, or the supposed helplessness. But in the process of gaining control over the inevitable misery, he becomes, automatically, anhedonic, which means being able or unwilling to enjoy pleasure. Anhedonia sets in stealthily. Over the years, it takes control of him. For example, he learns to defer gratification. This is a step in the dismal process of anhedonia. In learning to defer gratification, he experiences a sense of self-mastery. He has become stoic, disciplined. He does not give way to impulse. He has control. Control over himself in terms of his impulses, and control over the external situation. He is a controlled and controlling person. Pretty soon he has branched out and is controlling other people as part of the situation. He becomes a manipulator. Of course, he is not consciously aware of this. All he intends to do is lessen his own sense of impotence. But in his task of lessening this sense, he insidiously overpowers the freedom of others. Yet he derives no pleasure from this, no positive psychological gain. All his gains are essentially negative. Sherry Solvig had had cancer, lymphatic cancer, but due to valiant efforts by her doctors, she had gone into remission. However, encoded in the memory tapes of her brain was the datum that patients with lymphoma who go into remission usually eventually lose their remission. They aren't cured. The ailment has somehow mysteriously passed from a palpable state into a sort of metaphysical state, a limbo. It is there, but it is not there. So despite her current good health, Sherry, her mind told her, contained a ticking clock, and when the clock chimed, she would die. Nothing could be done about it, except the frantic promotion of a second remission. But even if a second remission were obtained, that remission too, by the same logic, the same inexorable process, would end. Time had Sherry in its absolute power. Time contained one outcome for her, terminal cancer. This is how her mind had factored the situation out. It had come to this conclusion, and no matter how good she felt, or what she had going for her in her life, this fact remained a constant. A cancer patient in remission, then, represents a stepped-up case of the status of all humans. Eventually, you are going to die. In the back of her mind, Sherry thought about death ceaselessly. Everything else, all people, objects, and processes had become reduced to the status of shadows. Worse yet, when she contemplated other people, she contemplated the injustice of the universe. They did not have cancer. This meant that, psychologically speaking, they were immortal. This was unfair. Everyone had conspired to rob her of her youth, her happiness, and eventually her life. In place of those, everyone else had piled infinite pain on her, and probably they secretly enjoyed it. Enjoying themselves and enjoying it, amounted to the same evil thing. Sherry, therefore, had motivation for wishing that the whole world would go to hell in a handbasket. Of course, she did not say this aloud, but she lived it. Due to her cancer, she had become totally anhedonic. How can one deny the sense in this? Logically, Sherry should have squeezed every moment of pleasure out of life during her remission, but the mind does not function logically, as Fat had figured out. Sherry spent her time anticipating the loss of her remission. In this respect, she did not postpone gratification. She enjoyed her returning lymphoma now. Fat couldn't make this complex mental process out. He only saw a young woman who had suffered a lot and who had been dealt a bum hand. He reasoned that he could improve her life. That was a good thing to do. He would love her, love himself, and God would love the both of them. Fat saw love, and Sherry saw impending pain and death over which she had no control. There can be no meeting of such two different worlds. In summary, as Fat would say, the modern-day masochist does not enjoy pain. He simply can't stand being helpless. Enjoying pain is a semantic contradiction, as certain philosophers and psychologists have pointed out. Pain is defined as something that you experience as unpleasant. Unpleasant is defined as something you don't want. Try to define it otherwise and see where it gets you. Enjoying pain means enjoying what you find unpleasant. Reich had the handle on the situation. He decoded the true dynamism of modern attenuated masochism, and so it spread out among almost all of us, in one form or another, and to some degree. It has become an ubiquity. One could not correctly accuse Sherry of enjoying cancer, or even wanting to have cancer. But she believed that cancer lay in the deck of cards in front of her, buried somewhere in the pack. She turned one card over each day, and each day cancer failed to show up. But if that card is in the pack and you are turning the cards over one by one, eventually you will turn the cancer card over, and there it ends. So, through no real fault of her own, Sherry was primed to fuck Fat over, as he had never been fucked over before. The difference between Gloria Knudsen and Sherry was obvious. Gloria wanted to die for strictly imaginary reasons. Sherry would literally die, whether she wanted to or not. Gloria had the option to cease playing her malignant death game any time she psychologically wished, but Sherry did not. It was as if Gloria, upon smashing herself to bits on the pavement below the Oakland Synanon building, had been reborn twice the size, with twice the mental strength. Meanwhile, Beth's leaving with Christopher had whittled horse-lover Fat down to half his normal size. The odds did not favor a sanguine outcome. The actual motivation in Fat's head for feeling attracted to Sherry was the locking in onto death which had begun with Gloria. But imagining that Dr. Stone had cured him, Fat now sailed out into the world with renewed hope, sailed unerringly into madness and death. He had learned nothing. True, the bullet had been pulled from his body and the wound healed, but he was primed for another, eager for another. He couldn't wait to move in with Sherry and save her. If you'll remember, helping people was one of the two basic things Fat has been told long ago to give up, helping people and taking dope. He had stopped taking dope, but all his energy and enthusiasm were now totally channeled into saving people. Better he had kept on with the dope.